Welcome to American Dissident Voices. I'm Kevin Alfred Strom. Why are white people so gullible? What makes us such easy marks for the sleazy swindlers who have hypnotized so many of our folk into believing that the real purpose of our lives is to fulfill the concocted wishes of an imaginary Jewish God, as recorded in 2,000-year-old imaginary Jewish fairy tales, who have made so many ordinary members of our race snarl with hate at any white man or white woman whom they suspect might want our race to continue to exist, who have tricked so many into believing that our deadliest enemies are really an elite chosen by God to rule over us. You're about to find out as we listen to the words of my mentor and friend, Dr. Revelo Oliver, in his groundbreaking 1968 speech, What We Owe Our Parasites. Today, we present part two of that speech. The following are the words of Revelo Pendleton Oliver. Listen.
Unless we have simply degenerated into a race of imbeciles, unfit to survive in the world, there must be some ascertainable mental block that makes us so gullible. And if so, we most urgently need to identify it. That's the real reason why I brought up the question of Senator McCarthy and what may have seemed history long past and otiose. That episode was obviously the antecedent of our present terrible plight. And when we try to look back at the obvious factors, such as the alien control of our channels of information and of our finances, we know there must be something back of that. And then we look at an obvious factor of which many were made aware only recently, the shocking behavior of so-called students in so-called universities, and by the far more shocking behavior of the administrative officers and faculties of those diploma mills. We now see that the gang of sleazy racketeers headed by John Dewey has attained its goal. We realize that the public schools have been for many years a vast brainwashing and brain-contaminating machine that has worked on the whole with great efficiency. It's a machine to which we send our children to have their minds filled with grotesque and debasing superstitions, to have their instincts of integrity and honor leached from their souls, to be incited to premature debauchery and perversion, to be imbued with thoughtless irresponsibility, and to be prepared for addiction to mind-destroying drugs and an existence below the animal level. The public schools have indeed been the most powerful single engine of subversion that our enemies have used upon us. And the rest of this hour would not suffice even to enumerate the ways in which the self-styled educators have accomplished their deadly work. When we go back to the affair of Senator McCarthy and look for a deeper cause, we can, of course, blame the schools, which were doing then, a little less openly, the work that they are doing now. But that leaves us with the question, why did the American people fall for that racket? Why were they gullible enough to be so easily taken in by John Dewey's hoax? Well, let us go back to 1917, when Dewey's fraud had gained control of only a relatively small area, and when the world was certainly a brighter and more pleasant place. That brings us, of course, to the time of Woodrow Wilson, another baleful figure in our history. I'm not one of those who regard Wilson as entirely a villain. I think that he was primarily a man who could intoxicate himself with his own words. And I think that he went through most of his life mistaking his hallucinations for reality. As surely as he did on that day in 1919, when he was driven in the early morning through the deserted streets of Washington, mechanically raising his hat and bowing to the applauding crowds that existed only in his feverish brain. I am therefore willing to believe that he believed a good deal of what he said. And although in his political life he was merely a marionette that danced and pranced on the stage as its strings were pulled by Jakob Schiff, Bernard Baruch, the Warburgs, and their agent Colonel House, the fact remains that Wilson ranted to the American people about making the world safe for democracy and a war to end wars, and they believed him. Instead of calling a physician when he began to babble that errant nonsense, they let him plunge them into a war in which they had no conceivable concern, and to use the power of the United States to make the result of that war as disastrous in the long run for Britain as it was for Germany. Now, I admit that the notion of a warless world is a pleasant and attractive thought. But people who believe that there can be such a thing should ask it of Santa Claus, in whom they doubtless also believe. Let us go back to 1909, when the American people were offered a plan for destroying nations that had been formulated again by a filthy degenerate named Mordecai, alias Karl Marx. Now, it's true that the promoters hired a few journalists, liberal professors, and other intellectual prostitutes to prove conclusively that the proposed income tax could never, under any circumstances, exceed 4% on the income of millionaires and could never affect anyone else, for the obvious reason that no federal government could possibly spend so much money. But the point is that a majority of the American people, the inheritors of a free government, based on the premise that government must be limited to essentials and must be tied down by the chains of a stringent constitution, restraining the exercise of all powers except those deemed absolutely necessary for national defense, those American people believed that hogwash. In effect, what the promoters were telling them in wheedling tones was, come, little bobies, put your heads into the noose and we'll do you lots of good. And the bubbies, little bobbies, stuck their necks into the noose. And so the country is now under the regime of the Great White Slave Act. And that's why we are where we are today. We could go much farther back. And if we had the time, we certainly should go back at least to the 18th century, when the weird mythology of what is now called liberalism and all of the basic lies that are rammed into the minds of our children in the schools were manufactured by a motley and bizarre gang composed of agents of Weishaupt's great conspiracy, many ordinary swindlers and mountebanks, and quite a bevy of idealists with buzzing brains and twittering tongues. But I think we have said enough to see that we Americans are suffering from a chronic disease or tropism that has invariably placed us at the mercy of our enemies by making us incapable of taking thought for ourselves. There is in us a weakness, perhaps a fatal weakness, that makes us not only listen to the babble of self-professed do-gooders, but to do whatever they tell us to do, and to do it as bindlessly as though we were in a hypnotic trance and had surrendered our will to that of the hypnotist. Now, I believe that this strange weakness, unlike so many of our peculiarities, is not a single congenital and hereditary idiocy. If that were true, we would not be here. Our remote ancestors would have been eaten long before the dawn of history. It is compounded, it seems to me, of a perversion of seven different qualities, a perversion effected and fostered by certain misunderstandings in the peculiar circumstances that resulted from the prosperity, power, and world dominion that we of the West achieved for ourselves and enjoyed in recent centuries. All of the seven elements of our mentality that I shall enumerate are good qualities, at least in the sense that they are born in us, that we could not eliminate them from our genetic heritage if we wanted to, and that we have perforce to accept them. We could comment at length on each of them, and it would be particularly interesting to contrast ourselves with other races at each point. But I must list them as briefly as possible, with only a word or two of explanation to make my meaning clear. The first is imagination, which is highly developed in us and vivid. An imagination which means, among other things, that we have a spiritual need of a great literature, both a literature of vicarious experience and a literature of the fantastic and marvelous that transcends the world of reality. But this gift bears with it, of course, the danger that we may not distinguish clearly between a vivid imagination and something that we can actually see in the world. Second, the sense of personal honor, which is so strong in us and seems so fatuous and silly to other races. It is this, among other things, that gives us the conception of an honorable contest when men of our race meet as opponents in war. It gives us the knightly ethos that you see when Diomedes and Glaucus meet on the plains of Troy, and in all the subsequent history and story of our race. It also exposes us to the danger of behaving in knightly fashion to those to whom those standards are lunacy. The third is the capacity for objective and philosophical thought, which is virtually limited to our race, and which enables us to put ourselves mentally in the position of others, but simultaneously exposes us to the risk of fancying that their thoughts and feelings are what ours would be. The fourth is our capacity for compassion. We have a racial reluctance to inflict unnecessary pain, and we are ourselves distressed by the sight of suffering. That is, of course, a peculiarity that brings upon us the ridicule and contempt of the numerical majority of the world's population, who are beings differently constituted. The savages of Africa, who are now your masters in the sense that you have to work for them every day, find the spectacle of a human being under torture simply hilarious. And when they see a blinded captive with broken limbs squirm as they prod him with red-hot irons, they laugh with glee, with a merriment, a real merriment, that is greater than the funniest farce on the stage has ever incited in you. You may search the vast and respectable literature of China in vain for any trace of compassion for suffering per se. Fifth, our generosity, both as individuals and as a nation. which naturally brings on us the contempt of those to whom we give abroad. The capacity for self-sacrifice is sixth, and that is, of course, highly developed in us, but it is a necessary basis for the existence of any civilized society. No people above the stage of unthinking savagery can survive in this world without some instinct or some belief which makes its young men give their lives for the preservation of the society in which they were born. And the seventh and last is the sentiment of religion, which of course is common to all mankind, although here again it takes a distinctive form in us. For 15 centuries, the religion of the Western world has been Christianity, Western Christianity, and there is no other religion now known or even imaginable that could take its place. But it is simply an historical fact which we must deplore but cannot change, that only a small part of our population today, 12 or 15%, really believes that Christ was the Son of God, that the soul is immortal, and that our sins will be punished in a future life. That means that the religious instinct, which is a part of our nature, finds in the majority of our people no satisfaction in an unquestioning faith. So that those frustrated instincts are available for exploitation by any halfway clever scoundrel. As the shysters and punks who now occupy the majority of our pulpits well know. When faith is lost, what Pareto calls the religious residue in a people becomes its most vulnerable point, its Achilles heel. It is the unsatisfied need for an unquestioning faith in a superior power. Now, a perversion of all of these qualities in us operated during the centuries of our dominance to give us an utterly false conception of other peoples. We have imagined that by some magic we could convey to them not only our material possessions, but the qualities of our mind and soul. And we have always succumbed to the flattery of imitation. The capacity for imitating behavior is common not only to all human beings, but to all anthropoids. As we well know from the proverbial expression, a monkey see, monkey do. An ape's ability to imitate is, of course, limited. But with the exception of the Australoids, other races have the capacity to imitate us convincingly in externals. If they dress in our clothes, observe our social conventions, and speak our language, using the phrases which, as they can learn by observation, please us, and using those phrases even if they don't understand them, or if they regard them as preposterous drivel and nonsense, the members of other races could imitate us so plausibly that we believe them converted to our mentality and to our conception of life. And any shortcomings that we may notice in the performance of the imitator, we generously overlook or regard as endearing naivete. This capacity for imitation is possessed by savages, at least by the more intelligent ones, and it has deceived us time after time. The British are as gullible as we are, and hundreds of times at least, they gave scholarships to blacks from Basutoland or Kenya or Nigeria or one of their other possessions, and the result was almost always the same. With the money given him, the savage bought himself a good wardrobe, attended an English school, learned to play soccer, attended Oxford, wrote a charming essay on Wordsworth or on ancient law, copulated with half-witted English women who thought him romantic and themselves broad-minded. And when he got tired of living on English generosity, went home to his tribe, where he had a well-roasted baby served up to him as a delicacy, of which he had been long deprived by the stupid prejudices of the stupid British. With some of the highly intelligent Oriental peoples, the capacity for dissimulation goes much farther than that and approaches genius. That strange and unique international people, the Jews, who for all the time in which they are known to history, have lived and flourished by planting their colonies in other people's countries, have owed much of their success to the chameleon-like ability to take on, when they choose, the manners and attitudes of whatever country they choose to reside in. They are a highly intelligent people, quite possibly much more intelligent than we are. But all observers, notably Douglas Reed and Roderich Stolheim, have commented on the Jews' amazing ability to seem a German in Berlin, a Czech in Prague, an Italian in Rome, and an Englishman in London, shifting from one role to the other with the ease with which a man might change his suit of clothes. The Jews have, of course, the great advantage that their skins are white, and that many of them resemble in features members of our race, even to the point of being indistinguishable, at least to an untrained eye, and of including persons with such non-Oriental characteristics as blonde or red hair. I am not sure, therefore, that the highest talent for dissimulation does not belong to a people that does not have that very great physical advantage, the Japanese. Their ability to gain our confidence and appropriate our technology and science is simply phenomenal, as is obvious from what they, living crowded together on a few poor islands, have accomplished. But their talent for dissimulation is equally great. I always remember the experience of a friend of mine who was in the late 1930s a professor of chemistry in a large university in what may be called a strategic area of this country. The outstanding students in his graduate classes were four young Japanese, and partly because they were so apt in learning the more abstruse forms of chemistry, and partly because they were foreigners and so excited in him the generosity that is normal to us, he invited them to his home, and in the course of 3 years, he came, he thought, to know them very well personally. Their manners and their English were excellent. They professed the greatest admiration for America and its institutions. They spoke, of course, democracy in terms of high praise. They deplored militarism, and they fervently hoped for world peace and understanding among all peoples. My friend was convinced that if only we could bring more young men like that to the United States, the policy of Japan would eventually change, and the two nations would live thenceforth in perpetual amity. Then one day, he found himself alone at a crossroads in the open country some 20 miles from the university, waiting for some friends to pick him up in their automobile. They were late, and since the day was hot, he went into a nearby orchard to repose in the shadow of the trees while waiting. He saw his four Japanese students come sauntering down one of the roads, evidently out on a leisurely hike. At the crossroads, they stopped, looked up and down each road, looked around and saw no one. Then they straightened up, stood back to back, each facing in one direction, produced a Leica camera, and photographed each road and then the surroundings on each diagonal, and made notations on a map. They had, of course, come to our country not only to learn our chemical science for eventual use against us, but also, incidentally, to map out the territory around the university for future reference, Should their army have occasion to invade us, or should they have occasion to land a secret force on our shores? And they went about their work with the patient thoroughness of their race, doubtless chuckling inwardly at the naivete of the big white boobies who freely deliver all their hard-won knowledge to their natural enemies. Our minds have been beclouded by an even more dangerous misconception long annexed to our religion. For centuries, we have labored under the illusion that Western Christianity was something that could be exported. And only recent events have at last made it obvious to us how vain and futile have been the labors and zeal of devoted missionaries for five centuries. When Cortes and his small but valiant band of iron men conquered the empire of the Aztecs, he was immediately followed by a train of earnest and devoted missionaries, chiefly Franciscans, who began to preach the Christian gospel to the natives, and they soon sent back home with innocent enthusiasm glowing accounts of the conversions they had effected. You can feel their sincerity, their piety, their ardor, and their joy in the pages of Father Sahagun, Father Torquemada, and many others. And for their sakes, I am glad that the poor Franciscans never suspected how small a part they had really played in the religious conversions that gave them such joy. Far more effective than their words and their book had been the Spanish cannon that had breached the Aztec defenses, and the ruthless Spanish soldiers who had slain the Aztec priests at their altars and toppled the Aztec idols from the sacrificial pyramids. The Aztecs accepted Christianity as a cult, not because their hearts were touched by doctrines of love and mercy, but because Christianity was the religion of the white men whose bronze cannon and mail-clad warriors made them invincible. That was early in the 16th century, and we of the West have gone on repeating that fond mistake ever since. As the missionaries whom we sent to all parts of the world wrote home with innocent satisfaction, glowing accounts of the number of hearts they had won for Christ. And it is only after the international conspiracies of campaign of anti-colonialism really got underway that most of us realized that what had won all those hearts was primarily the discipline of British regiments and the power of the white man. On many a shore of Africa, for example, missionaries eager to win souls ventured to land alone. And the natives, after having a lot of fun torturing them to death, ate them, either cooked or raw, according to the local custom. What often happened was that a few months later, a British cruiser hove to offshore and lobbed half a dozen 4.5-inch high explosive shells into the native village, and if not in a hurry, perhaps landed half a company of Marines to beat the bushes and drag out a dozen or so savages to hang on convenient trees. Unless the tribe was extensively stupid, they took the hint. The next bevy of missionaries was respected as somehow representing the god of thunder and lightning. And if those men of God distributed enough free rice and medical care with their sermons, they were able to make converts, many converts. They could teach a ritual, and they could perhaps inculcate a superstition that had some superficial resemblance to their religion. But as for teaching the spiritual substance of Christianity, they might as well have followed the example of St. Francis and delivered sermons to the birds. Although it is true that in some places in the former colonial possessions, missionaries are still tolerated, if they pay very well, we have at last learned that the gospel follows the British regiments in the white man's ignominious and insane retreat from the world that was his.
You have been listening to the second part of one of the greatest speeches of our times, Dr. Revelo P. Oliver's What We Owe Our Parasites. Be sure to join us again next time for part 3, right here on American Dissident Voices.